you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe. Space is filled with a network of wormholes. You might emerge somewhere else in space, somewhere else in time.
The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way.
The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelationships of the awesome machinery of nature.
I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos, which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky.
But the brain does much more than just recollect. It intercompares, it synthesizes, analyzes, it generates abstractions.
The simplest thought, like the concept of the number one, has an elaborate logical underpinning. The brain has its own language for testing the structure and consistency of the world. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars.
Are you ready?
I am ready and willing.
All right.
Bring it on.
That's how the show will start right there with Wes Bertrand. You've been on the show a bunch of times in the past, but this is the first time that you have ever called from the future.
From the future. Isn't that something? Yes, it is tomorrow from where you are, where I am.
So you're in Australia.
Sydney, Australia. It is. Yeah, it goes around the world ahead of time. And then by the time you get to like Fiji, it crosses over somewhere there in the middle of the Pacific into the earlier day, you know, where the earlier day starts, just west of Hawaii. So, yeah, down here, down under.
How's that going for you down there?
It's going well. Got a lot of rain last night. It's been warm too. It's starting summer. And the real bizarre thing is, you know, they go to the mall here and they actually have Christmas carols going, you know? And the one song I heard the other day, it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
Yeah.
And it's 80 degrees outside. Just not really happening.
Now, do they have Australian versions of these songs?
No, it's basically the boilerplate stuff.
The Bing Crosby?
Yeah, near as I can tell, it's pretty much the same stuff.
We did some Christmas carols on my show the other night. I had Marcus on from the Nothing Project, the one-man band, and we did Winter Wonderland together.
Excellent.
It was lovely. So yeah. I thought tonight we would talk about cognitive distortions, and this is a very important piece of the Logic series because I think emotional intelligence is often overlooked as a part of clear, coherent, and non-contradictory thinking. And these cognitive distortions, I'm just going to use the Wikipedia definition that we discussed. Cognitive distortions are exaggerated and irrational thoughts identified in cognitive therapy and its variants, which in theory perpetuate some psychological disorders. The theory of cognitive distortions was presented by David Burns in the Feeling Good Handbook in 1989 after studying under Aaron T. Beck. Eliminating these distortions and negative thoughts is said to improve mood and discourage maladies such as depression and chronic anxiety. The process of learning to refute these distortions is called cognitive restructuring. Now, they put this 1989 origin date, but you say it goes back even further than that.
Yeah, his original book, Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy, was published in 1980. So I think he mentioned quite a few of these in that one. And he may not have called them cognitive distortions, but I think he did, actually. You can look inside the book on Amazon. I'm sure we could find whether or not that's the case. But in any event, he drew from the work of Beck, Aaron T. Beck, sort of the founder of cognitive therapy, although the grandfather, I guess, would be Albert Ellis, rational emotive behavioral therapy. Interestingly, Ellis debated Nathaniel Brandon once, about, I think it was about morality, because Ellis was really against this whole notion of shoulding all over yourself, masturbation, in other words, telling right. yourself to do things. I should be doing this. I should not be doing that. It's all these demands upon the self. And he wanted to basically have people just be more at ease with themselves and just accept things as they are rather than always trying to change things. And of course, you know, Brandon, I'm sure, came back with the whole idea of prescriptive ethics, that you can't escape it. You know, you're basically saying you should not say shoulds, or you should not say should nots. Gets right. back to our fallacy of stolen concept, right?
Yeah.
So we just have to look at it from the context, the psychological context.
I was just talking about this. We had a caller on the show the other night who had called in with, you know, the situation that had just happened with his two young children, where he raised his voice and, you know, he was feeling pretty remorseful about that. And, you know, listening to him talk and, you know, wanting to, it's one of those situations that I think people find themselves in so frequently, where it feels like there is a right action to take, like there is something prescriptive that solves this problem, whether you're talking about, you know, a peer or a friend or a boyfriend or a girlfriend in crisis, in a situation with a child. And there isn't always that definite thing that you should do. And I think that's very hard for people to understand in those moments.
The process of just making demands that it should have been otherwise. There's actually a book by a couple of cognitive behavioral therapists titled Shoulda, Woulda, Coulda. And I forget what the subtitle was, but in any event, it's trying to grapple with this human process of regret, you know, of saying, gosh, I should have done that. And it'd have been nice if I would have done that. And things would have turned out differently. And, you know, then you've got the response to that, like, you know, no crying over spilled milk kind of thing, right? Just what do we do now? Now that we've done what we've done, we can't change the past. So what do we do now? So lots of different ways to look at how we figure out what's the best course of action and what was the best course of action, huh?
And another thing I think we should articulate before we go any further here. In the past on my show, I've talked about cognitive bias and differentiating cognitive bias from cognitive distortion. My understanding is that cognitive bias has to do more specifically with shortcuts in thinking, or, you know, like trying to follow maybe this mental script, while cognitive distortions are deeper level, deeper seated errors in thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. And oftentimes the cognitive bias can bleed into the relationships with others and discussions and arguments even. So I think it gets into the more intellectual stuff in that regard, whereas the cognitive distortions are mainly focused on how we talk about our self-concept and our capabilities and life in general and so forth. So how we cope with our own fallibility. I think that's kind of the emphasis in cognitive distortions, that somehow, somewhere in our past, we learn these ways of thinking about ourselves and thinking about life that can be pretty negative and lead to depression. And that's the reason why Beck got interested in this, to help people improve their moods, you know, to do this cognitive restructuring so that we're not thinking these negative thoughts, you know, these automatic negative thoughts, ants, they've been called.
Yeah, we've talked too in the past about the brain as a computer for its reasoning capabilities. And unfortunately for so many, there seems to be this Trojan program running in the background. And we think about all these great thinkers from, geez, let's do the spectrum from Karl Marx to Ayn Rand and then, you know, Nietzsche and Hegel. And we have all of these people who talked about the importance of reason. But so many of them, to varying degrees, were very troubled people. And it seems like it had a lot to do with their from what I can tell anyway, from their own internal dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, major internal dialogue going on. And a lot of these philosophers don't really touch on the nature of psychology's role in philosophy. And Ayn Rand herself told Nathaniel Brandon once that, "I don't really understand, or I don't know much about psychology. Forte was philosophy." And so that became kind of an Achilles heel in her thinking, even. Rand was way above the others in terms of clarifying things in the realm of epistemology and metaphysics, and even ethics, offering a non-sacrificial ethics, sort of for the first time in human history in a real explicit sense. But when it came to really discerning how to relate to herself and others, just read a couple books. The Passion of Ayn Rand, written by Barbara Brandon, Brandon's first wife. And My Years with Ayn Rand, Judgment Day, it's called, by Nathaniel Brandon. That's his memoir. And you'll see just the personal backstory here and how psychology's role in philosophy is just as significant as philosophy's role in psychology.
When you mentioned the word judgment, it actually reminded me of the show that we did the other night where we actually set out to cover cognitive distortions. And I had this, what I thought would be a fun article from Reason.com. Mm. And the title was, Who is Easiest to Fool, Smart Liberals, Conservatives, or Libertarians? Or maybe suggesting in the title, I might not have that quite right, I'll put it in the show notes, but that they were all equally easy to fool for different reasons. And one of the things that it suggested about conservatives specifically and libertarians is this absolutist, dogmatic kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm. And maybe some magical thinking that with libertarians that somehow in some way they're going to rise to power.
Oh, yeah. I think there is that aspect of it. And certainly that's not libertarian is a big umbrella these
Indeed.
Days.
Yeah, I wonder if they're just meaning the political persuasion, huh? The ones that are in the party?
That's what it seems. I think that's about as far as reason seems to go these days. They seem to have reined themselves in just a little bit. But I think a person could walk away with a basic understanding of objectivism in a really absolutist, dogmatic frame of mind about a lot of things that might, you know, maybe at a pretty crucial stage in their intellectual development, close them off or you know, turn them off to an open-mindedness that might be, it might not actually go anywhere as far as new ideas, but it still would be helpful to, you know, at least be willing to talk to other people.
Yeah.
Which is, that's something that I run into a lot here in New Hampshire, just talking to other free staters, and certainly it's not everybody, and I don't mean to generalize, but I've heard it several times. Well, I don't talk to ordinary, I don't talk to ordinary people.
The lowly peasants. But yeah, that was one of the reasons why David Kelly got excommunicated from the Ayn Rand Institute, because he had this crazy notion that it should be an open philosophy, and you should be able to talk to people like libertarians as an objectivist. Which is kind of ironic because, you know, libertarianism is basically the political branch of objectivism. So laissez-faire capitalism is what Ayn Rand promoted. And most libertarians, I would say, are for a small, minarchist, sort of limited government that just protects individual rights. And that itself, of course, is a contradiction and sort of a fantasy type of thinking that you can have an authority that's respectful in the realm of politics, even though it's coercive. So yeah, there's lots of divisiveness in ways that people deal with other people based on their own, you know, mental functioning, how they view the world. And like attracts like, of course. And there's this notion that the internet is kind of a double-edged sword because it creates these venues for people to get in these echo chambers and just associate with people that are of like mind. And they never really get the contrasting opinions. And I guess Facebook is probably a venue where you could get some contrasting opinions. Depends on who your friends are, right? Or friends of friends.
Sure. Yeah. People talk a lot about being unfriended, though.
That's true.
You know, I saw on somewhere on the internet yesterday, a good way to save money on buying Christmas presents is to post your political opinions on Facebook.
Nice.
Right? Because you can lose those friends. And you also have this anonymity and this distance that allows people to engage in these very adversarial discussions that they would not have in real life.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it can get very mean, very heated on there. So I try to stay out of that because I've never seen any of those threads really go anywhere positive.
Yeah, me too.
But I bet when people are taking those shortcuts, we could find a lot of these distortions there as well.
Yeah, and then especially the aftermath of the disputes and so forth, where people take what happened personally and as sort of a ding on their self-worth, in a sense. And that's more the realm of the cognitive distortions, because what are you telling yourself about what just happened? Are you jumping to conclusions? Are you overgeneralizing? Are you engaged in all or none thinking? Are you magnifying the crisis? Are you catastrophizing it even? You know, blowing it way out of proportion to what it is. Are you engaged in labeling of yourself or labeling of others?
Yeah, when I first saw this list, and what I think we should do, I think we should go through them one by one and maybe just talk about each for a couple minutes. Knowing the way we do things, that will probably get us through three of them in an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
But we can try it because I saw a lot of familiar territory and certainly things that I've been guilty of in the past, even on my podcast, which is more thought out and then after the fact edited than the real time discussions that I have with people out in the world. So do you want to try to go through the list and
sure,
see what kind of what we can generate here? All right. So the first one is all or nothing thinking, which is also called splitting. And this is conception in absolute terms like always, every, never, and there is no alternative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is interesting because it relates directly to what Marshall Rosenberg talks about with non-communication and how when we use this way of thinking, it's always this way or you never do that. I mean, if we direct it towards others, that's typically how he addresses it in nonviolent communication, although it can also be directed towards oneself. And it really locks one's thinking into a certain pattern that is problematic at best, you know?
Mm. Very, very rarely is, you know, an absolute characterization accurate. It's not not always inaccurate, but often it is.
Yeah, so that relates to checking to see if what you're saying is based on the facts of reality or if it's just what your subconscious is kicking out, right? Because this cognitive distortion stuff really happens on a subconscious level, these automatic thoughts, these super rapid subconscious appraisals about things. And this is why depression and anxiety and all these phobias and so forth are so hard to deal with because they are that sort of subconscious background play that goes on, like a recording in a sense. And so the process of disputation is necessary to really readjust what you're thinking and how you can actually relate it to a realistic view of reality rather than this, you know, distorted view. So an example that was on this other page of the five common cognitive distortions on Psych Central was, for instance, a person might tell themselves, I always fail when I try to do something new. I therefore fail everything I try. This is an example of the black or white or all or nothing thinking, polarized thinking it's called too. So the person is only seeing things in absolutes, that if they fail at one thing, they must fail at all things. You know, that would be also a hasty generalization, right? So it has a lot of similarities to the biases as well. If they added, I must be a complete loser and failure to their thinking, that would be an example of overgeneralization, taking a failure at one specific task and generalizing it to their very self and identity.
Sure. Yeah, so we see a lot of connections between logical fallacies here. Well, some of the ones that we've covered already, all or nothing thinking relates to the false dilemma or the false dichotomy, where, or even really the fallacy of the excluded middle, where it's a this or that binary choice. Mm-hmm. And the overgeneralization, as you said, is basically a hasty generalization where a person is making a broad conclusion using too few examples. It also technically, I guess, could be the fallacy of composition, where a person takes a specific thing that they do and or a specific area where they failed and said, here is an action that I did and I failed, and then compose it to apply to everything about them. Therefore, I am a failure.
As if that instance, particular concrete, is sufficient evidence to draw that general conclusion. You know, it's a process of induction that they're doing, but it's really premature, isn't it? And it's actually erroneous because it is our nature to be fallible, to make mistakes, is human, to err. But how do we deal with this in the midst of successive failures, for instance? You know, how it would relate to the whole educational schooling system is if you fail at a test, are you then a failure? You know, so we actually come up against systems that are designed to get us into this sort of all or nothing thinking. Or like in sports, if you're not a winner, then you're a loser.
Sure.
You know, but does that exhaust all the possibilities of human understanding and functioning? By no means.
Yeah, I think it's not always a complete remedy, but it can at least take away some of the negative impact of this is remembering to have some gratitude and to be appreciative for what is good. I was saying to a student that I was working with the other day who's, you know, having the typical, this is the last time I will do this tutoring where somebody is not doing well in school and, you know, I come in to try and help them out. And I asked them to make a list of things that he enjoyed about his life right now and his experiences generally. And I think that school can really be this overpowering force that makes you feel completely non-efficacious and powerless. Mm-hmm. And especially when it's it has that looming presence in your life and you're not doing well in this place where you spend 40 hours a week and then you spend another 15 hours a week supposedly doing homework for school. That's a real big part of your life. And if that's not going well, that can be really detrimental for a young person. So even though that tutoring session is supposed to be, oh, well, geez, you know, you have a D in biology, and what are we going to do about this D in biology? I think that that would be the parents' expectation and the school's expectation. But I thought, just from what I know and from my own experience and what I would want out of that situation, I think spending some time making a list of things to feel good about can offset, it's not a remedy, but it can offset the impact of the all or nothing thinking and the overgeneralizations of that situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that speaks to the cognitive behavioral therapy process of this cognitive restructuring, looking at the evidence, first identifying what are those automatic thoughts, and then disputing them, right, to identify what distortions they are, and then dispute those things, look for counter evidence, look for evidence that shows that, hey, my life is really great in many respects. You know, this cultivation of gratitude is something that the positive psychology movement has been focusing on as well. And then just developing a new way of thinking about it. And of course, this is a conscious process, you know, so it takes some time to restructure those subconscious automatizations. And a lot of people, I mean, there is a criticism on the Wikipedia page, you know, that's somewhat warranted. It says, that I forget where the quote is, but something of the effect that the person has to do the behavior, like there needs to be the follow through. You can't just kind of restructure your thoughts in your head and then everything's fine. It takes repeated attempts to do this, and then the follow through in your behavior, acting differently to prove and disprove the things that you were assuming were the case about yourself or about others.
Mm, yeah. So some maintenance.
Yeah. Yeah. There needs to be the follow through.
Yeah. And there's other pieces of, obviously, a lot of other pieces of cognitive restructuring that we can maybe talk about a few more as we go on here. The next one is magical thinking, expectation of specific outcomes based on performance of unrelated acts or utterances. So see also wishful thinking.
Mm-hmm. Wishful thinking. Yeah. How does that relate to the personal experiences of people and how they deal with themselves, you know, in terms of if their mood is really down, what sort of wishful thinking would they be engaging in to foster that mood? It's interesting. It's almost as if this one is apart from the other distortions, because this is indulging in fantasy to somehow assuage some feelings of down mood, engaging in the ritual, prayer, sacrifice, observance of a taboo or unexpected benefit or recompense. And so if we click on wishful thinking, they have a whole Wikipedia write-up for that one, as well as magical thinking.
Ah. Oh, sure. Okay. So this makes perfect sense. Formation of beliefs in and making decisions according to what might be pleasing to imagine instead of by appealing to evidence, rationality, or reality. Oh, so this is wildly popular.
Wildly. Yeah. It's not going out of style anytime soon, is it?
Right. Right. I think in mainstream political thinking, there might be a lot of wishful thinking, but very rarely would somebody say, oh, well, you know, frankly, I just believe what is most comfortable to believe. And a really negative way of characterizing a lot of what goes on in the political mainstream is realizing what beliefs make you feel the most comfortable, and then basically to stop thinking and to start doing confirmation bias. And I know that's certainly not everybody. I think it feels that way sometimes, but people who might be engaging in a lot of wishful thinking still really want to, just from my experience, want to go through the motions of being information seekers. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you know, I watch the news. I read the New York Times. I get the other side, even though I'm a conservative. I watch CNN, you know, that kind of thing. So it's not like I'm saying, oh, please don't disturb me with new information. But there's a lot of times where I feel like I've tried to provide new information, and the other person's reaction was that of somebody who was very disturbed by it.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost the land of pretentiousness, huh? To assume that one has knowledge that one actually doesn't have, or to be righteous about the knowledge that one has and not looking for more evidence, more opinion, more discussion on the subject, more information.
Sure, but on the other hand, that was a very big problem with me, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who was maybe a little bit overbearing and pedantic and pompous at times with the feeling like I had the monopoly on reason and morality.
Yeah.
And that was one of the downsides of these moral arguments, is that you almost wind up shaming, even if indirectly or subtly, you wind up shaming people who believe anything else, and that really gets you nowhere.
Yeah, it reminds me of our discussion earlier about objectivism and how that can be a really, useful device, if you will, for that that sort of logic, you know, to be able to defeat your opponents because you know more about the philosophy than they do, and you can ferret out the contradictions pretty easily. But is that really helpful? Is that helpful for the discussion and helping that other person understand contradictions and see the value in reconciling them?
I think, however sound it might be from, you know, the thinking side of it, it might feel, as far as like the impact that it's going to have on somebody else, it might feel a lot, that sort of logic might feel a lot like somebody trying to use the sword of God, you know, the yeah. evangelical, to sure. argue against gay marriage or something like that. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people are really strangers to, you know, reason and evidence as a way of forming a belief system. And actually going through the process of doing it. And when you present that to people in this, what often comes across as a very pompous presentation, that's going nowhere productive.
No, it doesn't really leave the conversation open for an understanding, a more empathetic understanding of self and others. It's more of that absolutism, which is, you know, fine in the context of certain concepts and our understanding of reality, but in relation to, you know, discussions and relationships and relating knowledge to others and being comfortable with our fallibility, that's another thing, a degree of a humbleness process, because anybody can make mistakes, you know? And mm-hmm. I think that's a very important thing for children to learn too, that adults make mistakes all the time, whoppers even, and they perpetuate them. That's the really disheartening thing about when we're blind to the cognitive biases and the distorted thinking, that we end up, you know, perpetuating mistakes that put us in a worse emotional realm and a worse societal realm.
Now, the next one I would say does apply to liberty-minded people very frequently. It's called mental filter. The inability to view the positive or negative features of an experience, for example, noticing only a tiny imperfection in a piece of otherwise useful clothing.
Yeah.
But there, and this I think goes both ways, there is this period of time that is either referred to as the Gilded Age or the Age of the Robber Barons, depending on who you ask to tell you about it. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a topic that libertarians often shy away from, where there were far fewer restrictions on the market, and people in industrial settings really were not being treated very well. And there is some context that's missing from the presentation of this time period in most college history or economics classes, for sure. But you also, I think there's also a lot of this in mainstream politics where, well, it's a little different, but people pretending a problem doesn't exist because they don't like the proposed solution for it. Mm-hmm. So whatever the negative experience is, it's just discounted as non-existent, or the person who's bringing this negative experience or situation or this problem up is just being an alarmist.
Yeah. What's an example of that one?
Climate change. So I've never cracked a book on climate change in my life. Do I see all kinds of motives for all kinds of people to make up something called climate change and say, this is why we need to do X, Y, and Z totalitarian thing? Sure. Yes. But I don't have a strong opinion on that one way or the other. It seems that, there is evidence that this is a real thing. It doesn't matter to me whether it's real or not, because what I would see as the prescription would not change. I wouldn't say, oh, well, geez, then yes, we need to give land to the UN and have all of these new government programs. I would never say that. So it doesn't matter to me one way or the other. But in mainstream conservatism, let's say, they might just call them, global warming alarmists, while liberals, on the other side of the mental filter, the term that they came up with is climate change deniers. Just so you have that hint, just so you have that little Holocaust-y thought in the back of your mind when someone says, climate change deniers.
Which is stacking the deck, isn't it? We have all this evidence. It's abundant. There's a consensus in the scientific community. And so therefore, of course, you're a denier if you believe a contrary opinion, or you just want to withhold your opinion and see if we can get some more evidence on this subject, given that a lot of these predictions and so forth are based on computer models. And what was the information that they inputted to get what they wanted out of the model, right? I mean, there's all kinds of things that need to be taken into account. So, lots of mental filtering happening there.
And I would think that the mental filter is a really big part of perpetuating two-party politics in this country, where you have to really amplify whatever minuscule positive attributes there might be of one political party and really crank down the volume on the myriad negative features of that party to continue supporting that party. Or what you can do is you can just amplify the negative features of the other party and don't even worry about the question of, is there any positive features of the political ideology that I have or not? It doesn't matter because the other side is so bad. So I think, the mental filter distortion really is maybe what's keeping that system going in a lot of ways.
It really does. I mean, there was a panel discussion my friend Edwin had on his website, cultureofempathy.com. And what his goal was is to have like two Republicans, two Democrats actually engage in this process of empathizing with each other's views. And there was a lot of reflective feedback through the process where they're basically reiterating what the other person, what they thought the other person said. And it was quite unusual for them to do that. And one of them actually didn't really like the whole process because they thought it was a little bit too obvious, like when someone says something, then repeating it back to them in a different way or paraphrasing it seemed to be a little bit time consuming, I guess, is what his perspective was. But nonetheless, you could see how if they kept on engaging in that process, they would, and some of them actually mentioned this, that they would find a lot more common ground than not. There'd be less mental filtering that would happen, so they wouldn't be magnifying the negatives of the other side and minimizing their own negatives, and then magnifying their positives and minimizing the negatives or the positives of the other side, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And language really plays into that as well, the programming of language. And, you know, I have people in my family who are very strongly oriented to the left and then again to the right. And if the debate was over something like Social Security, and I was to change the language from Social Security to raise your hand if you want old people to be poor and die, right?
Or just eat cat food.
Suddenly, yeah. So suddenly we find out, Republican and Democrat, that there's a lot more agreement here than we thought we had. When we're debating the language that we have been given called universal health care, and the question becomes, would you like medical care to be affordable for every person who needs it? You know, if that's the question, boy, again, we just found a bunch of agreement that we didn't think existed before when we were using the programming language that the government and the media provided for us. So that also would lead to more common ground. But I think that the emotions go too fast. You know, the conversation gets too much momentum and people don't even stop and say, should we define our terms? Should we clarify what we're talking about here? And because you get to a point where you can end any political argument where it's like, you know, do you want bad things to happen to people? Do you want these bad things to happen to people? No. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you both agree on that. Everything else is out of your control.
Yeah.
Right. So stop talking about the government like it's your fantasy football team. Everything else is out of your control. You are, a well-meaning person. Stop waiting for the state, the people calling themselves the government, to honor your wishes and aspirations for society.
Yeah, it's as if they're locked into a particular one-size-fits-all strategy, you know, which is governmental coercion. And whoever seizes control of that strategy is going to get their values placated, apparently. But if you look at all the evidence, that's far from the case. And all this talk of free healthcare, I mean, reminds me of that quote I used in my book by Dave Barry. You know, if you think healthcare is expensive now, wait until you see what it costs when it's free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, free in quotes, of course. So freedom really means honoring people's ability to make their own choices with their own property and engage in contracts with other people. So, so many contradictions are wrapped up in these authoritarian notions that government is going to provide for people. But on the personal side of mental filter, you know, which is probably what Burns was more focused on, is when you discount some of the positive aspects of something, like to always look on the dark side or to always look on the bright side. You know, there are certain ways to cope with things in reality, right? And there are certain payoffs, of course, to look at everything, to see the negative in everything. You know, the glass is half empty all the time.
Yeah, and the gloominess that... I've certainly met people like this and maybe been in a few of these, doldrums in my own life. The gloominess that just casts over everything when everything is immediately oriented to the negative.
Yeah, yeah. And especially it's really tragic with children when they learn that sort of message from parents who are in, you know, quote, bad moods. You know, they haven't enabled their process of feeling good so much. And then the kids attribute that to, well, this is what happens when you become an adult. You know, this is the real world. As opposed to seeing things in a healthy, sort of happy-oriented fashion.
Yeah. Life isn't always fair.
Yeah. As opposed to people's strategies aren't always fair. That's the real truth.
Yeah.
Life just is, you know?
Yeah. The next one is, I think, related to this in a lot of ways, disqualifying the positive, discounting the positive experiences for arbitrary ad hoc reasons, if having reasons at all, I guess. I mean, that's pretty much the gloominess of the mental filter, I think, that we were just describing, right?
Yeah, I think that's pretty specific about that.
Yeah. The other one that relates to this is magnification and minimization. Magnifying or minimizing a memory or situation such that they no longer correspond to objective reality. This is common enough in the normal population to popularize idioms such as make a mountain out of a molehill. In depressed clients, often the positive characteristics of other people are exaggerated and the negative characteristics are understated. There is one subtype of this magnification, catastrophizing. The inability to foresee anything other than the worst possible outcome, however unlikely, or experiencing a situation as unbearable or impossible when it is just uncomfortable. I'm going to throw it to you here because I'm really trying to resist tying all of these things to politics, which just so readily comes to mind for some reason, for so many of these.
It really does, doesn't it?
It does, and that's too bad because I would definitely like to have this more focused on the personal, and I think the two are definitely related.
Yeah,
you know, it all ties together.
If it weren't for the personal processes going on here like this, you probably wouldn't see it in the realm of politics, would you?
Yeah, I think that I think that's not really maybe the most direct application. I think politics is more what shows up in the end. Politics is a symptom. Right, it's not the problem.
A derivative outcome of these ways of processing your world. You know what's alive in you at the time, and you know disqualifying the positive and magnification and catastrophizing. It reminds me of that character in Winnie the Pooh. That donkey, was it?
Eeyore.
You know, oh bother.
Yeah.
Eeyore. Yeah. So that kind of represents that sort of fallacious thinking about self. And you know, they've done studies about people who are depressed, and I think they draw this conclusion sometimes that depressed people are more realistic, you know, but optimistic people are more happy, you know. So is there a grain of truth in when you look at reality for what it is? Does it bring about a depressed mood because things are not how one wants them to be? It's not all a great place. And maybe that's why people engage in this magical thinking of an afterlife, a heaven, a place that is, you know, really nice, you know, endlessly nice, eternally joyful.
Well, I think that there could be a number of reasons for that. But some of the people that I've encountered in my life, and I've met religious people who this does not apply to, but I can think of a couple of examples from the past where people who were very, 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 very miserable, and it almost seemed like they had given up on this existence. And they were directing their energy. In one case, one woman I know, even her money was giving like half of her income to the church to, you know, basically assure her reservation in this this paradise afterlife. And it was a very powerful way, I think, for controlling people, too, of deferring the reward or deferring the punishment, you know, depending on how well you do here. But, yeah, I think that's certainly a possibility.
Yeah. I wonder about why it is that there are so many thought processes subconsciously that are oriented more towards this, the downside. And I guess if you relate it to some, I think I was watching a TED Talks about this, and it's been talked about numerous times, might have been Scientific American, but the fact that in the wild, in our history, ancestral past, we had to be oriented towards dangers. Otherwise, we'd get weeded out of the gene pool.
Yeah.
So we're naturally prone to jump to that conclusion, which leads to that other distorted thought process, that there's a tiger in the bushes rather than a rabbit. Because that could save our life, even though there's no tigers around anymore.
Yeah, I think how that translates to a day where we're you know less worried about what kind of animal in the bushes. Even though I think that's a great example as far as maybe you know more of our deeper programming is concerned, but it still is a defense mechanism, and it's a defense mechanism. It seems against disappointment, which sucks, and feeling betrayed, which sucks. And if you just always maybe not expect the worst, but expect nothing good to happen, well, you don't have to worry about disappointment or betrayal or, you know, being all built up just to be let down. There was a big craze a few years ago. I think it was the secret or the law of attraction, right?
Yes.
And I didn't like the magical thinking aspect of it. And I kind of felt like that it was really irresponsible because there was an important lesson to learn there. Certainly plenty of times in my life, and I've seen this in other people's lives that I was close to, the experience will often line up with the expectation pretty nicely or not so nicely, depending upon what the expectation is. And the people I knew who were very negative, they always seemed to like find the next negative thing to complain about. You know, and people who were more positive or more optimistic seemed to integrate that stuff and kind of take it in stride and ride out that storm a little bit better because they were more focused on, you know, the next positive thing or the lemonade that could come from this lemon that they encountered. So I think there was some truth to that. I just didn't like all the magic of it in The Secret.
Yeah, because it can tend to sort of blame the person who hasn't affected the proper change in reality, like, you know, hasn't manifested their dreams because they're not thinking in the way that they need to be. They're not positive enough, right? It's their fault that things didn't manifest themselves. So they need to go back to the drawing board and keep attuned to that, you know, the power of positive thinking stuff rather than just look at the causal relationships in reality and get more realistic about what strategies are going to best bring about the goals that you seek, you know? One of the things I really admire about Ayn Rand, and this speaks to philosophy's role in psychology, is, you know, her book, a series of essays she wrote in the Romantic Manifesto. And she talked about sense of life. And this is what she called a preconceptual equivalent to one's metaphysics. So she endorsed what she called the benevolent universe premise. And not in the sense that reality or the universe is by nature benevolent to us, but that it's open to a benevolent sense of life, that you can achieve things as an organism called human beings on the planet Earth because of your nature, because you have the capacity to reason and figure things out and to discern truth and to recognize errors and correct those errors. I mean, if you start thinking about the power of the human mind to accomplish things, it's pretty incredible. I mean, it's absolutely wondrous and amazing. And I really admire the fact that she focused on that and wanted to have people realize the best within themselves, you know, to look at reality with this brilliant sense of life, you know, that things are possible, things can be achieved. And she credited a lot to the American sense of life, you know, the can-do attitude. She liked that novel Calumet K, I think it was called, where this guy was making a grain elevator of sorts, and it was just his mind's application to bring something to fruition against various odds, you know. And
sure.
So there's a lot to be said to that, you know, that if you have these explicit philosophical premises that you can accomplish things, that your mind is efficacious, which relates to Brandon's concept of self-esteem, that you can think about things clearly and sort out contradictions and rid your world of biases when they come along in your thinking, then you can actually achieve happiness, you know, and this whole process becomes self-fulfilling, like a virtuous upward spiral of fulfillment. One of the problems that can arise is when you just adopt the philosophy to say, this is how I want to live, and this is really great. And Brandon talks about this in his book, The Disowned Self, where many new budding objectivists acquire her philosophy, but they haven't done the psychological work, you know, to go into the subconscious and try to ferret out those assumptions that were learned really early in their lives. So instead of doing that, they would sort of discount it or disown that part of themselves and kind of will themselves to be happy and efficacious, which is a really hard thing to do when you have these automatic things going on in your subconscious that can come out in all kinds of ways. And, you know, as all parents know, these sorts of things get triggered when we're in the midst of children, when they're doing things that that activate these past patterns and traumas.
So what about that old adage, fake it till you make it?
Fake it till you make it. Kind of like if you smile, even though you're not happy, you sort of activate the same brain regions to lift your mood.
Well, yeah. And I mean, they say fake it till you make it about a lot of things, about, you know, even your confidence in in other people. And yeah, I don't know. I don't think that, I guess it depends on the person, you know, like maybe acting more confidently. I heard a story on, Sex, Lies, and Anarchy in their last episode. They were talking about pickup artists, and Celestina was talking about this friend that she had when she was younger who just really, really lacked self-confidence and created a character in this role-playing game that they were doing where the character was very confident and very assertive. And the outcome in real life later on was that this person took some of the positive attributes of this fictional character and incorporated them into her real life. Mm-hmm. So I think it's possible, but maybe is that still just presentation? And is everything that was making that person unhappy or lacking confidence still there beneath the surface? And how stressful is that?
Yeah, like those two therapists I saw interviewed on Charlie Rose's show talking about the tools for kind of getting out of the doldrums of procrastination, for instance. Mm-hmm. And one of the chapters they have talks about really facing your shadow self. They use these Jungian terms, and the shadow self is the part of yourself that you're scared of, you don't like, that you're fearful of really recognizing and seeing because you don't know how it could affect you, and you just try to spend a lot of your time not focusing on it, right? But it ends up becoming influential in not so helpful ways sometimes. But in any event, I think really doing that restructuring behaviorally can cause some restructuring mentally. So if you're just going through the motions as if you're that person who has a lot of confidence and has resolved those inner contradictions subconsciously, you're kind of telling your part of your mind, your brain, that you can do this because you are, you know? Yeah. But then you hear, you know, actresses and actors talk about their insecurities and how they actually enjoy getting in the role because it's not them. And they can really exude this confidence and all these different traits of characterization in those roles. But deep down, they know that that's not really them, you know? So they really haven't dealt with those insecurities.
Sure. And I mean, I can certainly remember when I said yes, a couple of minutes ago, I can identify with that. There were times, and they were smaller things, and maybe certainly of some significance. It's nothing to the extreme of like the, you remember the Urkel character on Family Matters?
Yes.
How he would become Stefan, the ladies' man.
Yes.
Like his alter ego. All right. So it wasn't anything to that extent. But there were times where I was doing this podcast and I would listen back to, you know, a show from a couple months prior, or I would be tutoring and I would say, boy, either I shouldn't be doing this or I should be taking my own advice. Because, you know, I'm suggesting things to people that I am not really a master of in my own life. And
but isn't that how we become masters? You know, that's like, Brandon focused on self-esteem because he really wanted to master that.
But how close is that to faking it until you make it?
I guess maybe faking it till you make it is a bit self-denigrating, you know, just the explicit terminology that's used there. But I think in terms conceptually, it's not very different at all. Because in point of fact, and this is what I love about objectivism and Rand's perspective on it, you know, where she said, redeem your mind from the hawkshops of authority, which means every other person out there that you've sacrificed your own thinking to. Right? And every belief system that you've sacrificed your thinking to, you know, accept the fact that you are an individual and you only achieve things through your own mental fortitude and thinking about things. You know, of course, as you relate to other people and you get your life enriched by the information they share and the relationships and all that. But at the end of the day, metaphysically, you are alone. And if you realize this, then you soon realize that other people are in the same predicament. So no one has any special access to knowledge or skills or abilities. It's all about this learning process. Right. So I think that can provide some comfort or security in this process of, you know, evolving and increasing one's talents and skills and abilities and knowledge.
Right. So we have four more of these, and the next one I think relates to what you just said as maybe a shortcut to comfort and maybe perhaps a shortcut to discomfort, depending on how you use it. Emotional reasoning. Experiencing reality as a reflection of emotions. For example, I feel it, therefore it must be true. That one can go either way.
That's a popular one, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so being able to differentiate identifications of things in reality as well as the things in your own mind and be able to keep those things distinct rather than blend them together, you know, because you're basically blinding yourself to the real reality when you're just in the emotional realm of wishing it so, wanting it to be the case. And I guess this one relates to the magical or wishful thinking as well, huh?
Yeah, it's certainly a strong tie-in here with interpersonal and, well, really romantic relationships. And it reminds me of Steph's book, Real-Time Relationships, The Logic of Love. And, you know, early in a courtship, people might experience these emotions that are objectively lust or infatuation, but we don't label our emotions as lust and infatuation a lot. We call that love, you know, if a person isn't thinking carefully about what's really going on there. And I think he even, you know, gives a time frame of like the first 6 months where there's kind of this emotional drunkenness for a lot of people. And they say, oh, well, this would be a good time for us to plan our lives together. So that I feel it, where it is very nebulous, but we're going to call it love and it must be true. So I think emotional reasoning can go a lot of different places.
Yeah, and then imbuing reality, and this gets back to Rand's benevolent universe premise, when people imbue reality with malevolence even, you know, that life is not fair, it's out to get me, it's impossible to achieve things, these kinds of things, that can really be a direct example of this emotional reasoning, you know, when your emotions are such that it's really hard to see reality clearly. Then you know that it's important to give yourself some empathy and show some compassion for what you're feeling so that you're able to relax more and get more attuned to those feelings so that you can differentiate them from what actually is the case. And that's like the whole point of Burns's book, Feeling Good, is really looking at reality and finding evidence to discount or dispute these negative automatic assumptions, these subconscious appraisals, you know?
And the judgments that they lead to.
Yeah. The write-up for emotional reasoning is pretty interesting. Cognitive process that occurs when a person believes that what he or she is feeling is true regardless of a presented evidence or presented evidence. Got some typos on this page. As an example, a person who is nervous or anxious and resorts to emotional reactions to determine a course of action. For instance, an anxious test taker, we can't escape this test thing, can we? Might feel that he does not understand the material. He might feel as though he doesn't understand at all, but in fact is perfectly capable of answering the questions, in fact, you know, and is merely insecure about it. By acting on the basis of his insecurity, he might assume he does not know the answers and guess randomly. Thus, he creates a self-fulfilling prophecy of failure. In this way, emotional reasoning amplifies the effects of other cognitive distortions.
And again, the experience matches the expectation in that case. Yeah. And so can you read the first line of that again?
Sure. So it says, emotional reasoning is a cognitive process that occurs when a person believes that what he or she is feeling is true regardless of the presented evidence.
Okay, so that also connects to cognitive dissonance.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody has already become comfortable with what is very much a belief, and then in the face of new evidence, where they have to momentarily hold these two contradictory ideas, one based on emotion, one based on evidence, together, the emotional wins and the evidence-based is discarded.
And so reality kind of goes out the window. And, you know, it's important to understand that reality is sort of our closest friend and safeguard, because this is what is us. You know, as Carl Sagan says, we are star stuff. You know, we're the results, the heavy elements in our bodies are the result of supernova explosions. And so we are a part of reality, star stuff, able to navigate through reality, other parts of reality, and see and question aspects of reality. So it's not that we are somehow this foreigner in a strange world that we never created or never made. We are a part of it. So to embrace reality is really to embrace ourselves. That's the way that objectivism tends to portray this philosophical understanding of the world and ourselves, you know?
Yeah. I brought up what's that song came to mind?
Oh, yeah?
When you say, I hear, first of all, I hear...
We are the world? No.
I hear Sagan in my head saying, "The iron in your blood is the product of supernova explosions from 100,000 years ago." Yes. At the same time, I hear Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and I feel like you should have a headband on with a peace sign. Exactly. Two very different things, but what is that song? I'm going to figure out what it is and use it as bumper music.
Your right hemisphere is very active today, Brett. Lots of creativity going on there. And then there's a part in that, what do they call it, auto-tuning? Where they have Carl Sagan's thing that's auto-tuned. You know, like the double rainbow guy that they auto-tune his wacky statements?
Yeah, yeah.
But in that statement by Sagan, you know, here's how to make an apple pie from scratch. First, yeah. You start with, supernova explosion. Kind of gives you chills, you know, just to... take it all in, the big perspective on stuff.
I will look that up and possibly include it here. The next one I thought we might spend a little bit of time on should statements. Patterns of thought which imply the way things should or ought to be rather than the actual situation the person is faced with. Or having rigid rules which the person believes will always apply no matter what the circumstances are. Albert Ellis termed this cognitive distortion. All right, so that's the origin of that term.
Yeah, Albert Ellis didn't like this whole process because he saw it as irrational, that there are always more possibilities than what are confined in the realm of the should and the should not. You know, and when you read the rigid rules, I thought of the, you know, status laws. It's the law, and we always have to put up with death and taxes, you know?
Ooh, but the flip side of that. Now, here's a criticism that's been leveled against me in my conversation with some of the political folks that I know. They say, Brett, you're a real one-trick pony. You know, like no matter what,
all kinds of ways, huh?
No matter what the issue is, the problem is the government. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Like yeah. So.
Well, it is actually the biggest elephant in the room that's not really talked about, isn't it?
Well,
I mean,
sure.
The coercion is not really talked about.
Yeah, and to rationalize my being such a one-trick pony, maybe I'm overcompensating for what nobody else wants to talk about. But I do also understand that criticism, right? Where it seems like the world, and I don't mean to say this in a cynical way, but the world is in many ways kind of a sick place because of a lot of these things that are never explored and never dealt with, and that manifests in all of these symptoms that people often label as problems of deeper things. So we get into these false dichotomies and these judgments of the government versus corporations, and we find ourselves defending one of them, which is insane. You know, that doesn't make
it
any
really
sense.
It really is.
Yeah. So because there is no, you have two different groups of people with two different labels basically engaging in the same kind of, bad behavior. But...
yeah.
I think.
Well, I guess in reply, you could say something like, "Okay, would you like us to talk about cognitive distortions?"
Yeah,
you know, if to bring it back from politics to the personal, if you'd like to discuss that, that's actually more fundamental, isn't it?
Sure, sure. But no, I think that what often happens is, I would say, or somebody in a similar position would say, well, you're a one-trick pony. You say the answer to every problem is government, right? But then we're just in that spiral of going
tit
nowhere.
For tat, yes.
Yeah. Mm. So, yeah, I think that would be interesting. And I've avoided discussions like this altogether for some time. But if another opportunity presents itself, maybe I should carry a hand list of these with me. And, you know, we could each have a copy. And, you know, I could say, before we go any further, maybe we could read through this and, you know, put a check mark next to the ones you think I'm doing, and we'll talk about it.
Uh-huh. The pony found another trick.
Oh, two tricks.
Because you could also, you know, weave in the whole cognitive biases as well as cognitive distortions.
Sure.
And I think if we focused on these things, you know, and ferreted out the contradictions and the faulty reasoning, you wouldn't really even need to talk about government, because it would be so obvious how insane it is, the whole institution and what it does to and for people.
Yeah. Now, I did draft a political debate contract, but this was much more of a stunt, right?
Yeah.
And was kind of for entertainment. Now, there might have been, it might have provided a good learning opportunity, but it needed to be rewritten in a way that was a little bit less like me saying, hey, here's a list of logical fallacies that you make all the time and I avoid, and I'd like you to sign this agreement that you won't make them. Right.
So exactly. I want you to change your psychology and philosophy on the spot with the signature.
Right. So if it was presented in a more constructive way, it might provide a good learning opportunity. But the way I presented it on my show, maybe, I don't know, 15 or 20 episodes ago, was partially for entertainment purposes. And I acknowledge that. But this is really getting more at the heart of the matter, the cognitive distortions. And, you know, to present that to somebody and ask for the same criticism, like, you know, that we could do it to each other. It's not criticism, but maybe evaluation, and maybe trying to constructively point out some of these errors that we both could be making. Because I see, you know, a lot of my past, not just emotionally and personally, but also rhetorically here, and, you know, mistakes that I think are pretty common to liberty-minded people. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ooh, like the next one. But anything else on should statements?
You know, like I mentioned before, it's also called masturbation. I think It's a very popular thing, though. And I sort of spoke about it in this last podcast I did, episode 175, which has taken me forever to get posted, but it will be posted soon. But the anger, you know, that people have about things, about themselves, about reality, all this, it's really rooted in this should idea, the should thinking. Things should be different than how they just went. Therefore, I'm pissed off. You know,
right.
You should have done this, but you didn't. Therefore, that pisses me off. You know, those kinds of things.
Right. And, that demand for of yourself and of another person for control, your own control over that situation, I think is how that comes through.
Yeah, you want to get your needs for efficiency, for efficacy, and for ease met, but for some reason or another, it's not happening. So how do you best manage that sort of impulse to get mad and the actual emotion of getting mad, you know, to look, to find out what are the emotions underlying that? You know, there's a degree of pain that's happening because the way I wanted it to be is not how it is. And I think the whole should sort of thinking, people should do this and they shouldn't do that and this, that, you know, this, that, and the other. I think that's kind of a shortcut way of solving this psychological issue, isn't it? And it basically leads to a dead end. This shortcut doesn't really get us to where we want to be.
I was definitely, the word shortcut comes to mind, and that immediate gratification. I don't know why we still refer to it as gratification of exploding on somebody and judging and labeling and that often is the route that people take. So
yes.
I said the next one rings a few bells. Labeling and mislabeling. Limited thinking about behaviors or events due to reliance on names related to overgeneralization. Rather than describing the specific behavior, a person assigns a label to someone or himself that implies absolute and unalterable terms. Mislabeling involves describing an event with language that is highly colored and emotionally loaded. Now, you and
is this
and
relate me. To politics at all?
Okay, yes. But both of us, if you go back in the Complete Liberty podcast feed to, say, 2009, just about every time that we are talking about somebody who works for the government or is a politician, we use the term authoritarian sociopaths.
Indeed, we do. We committed major sins. What are we going to do to repent for these sins, Brett?
and your other co-host, Mike, never missed Michael. An opportunity. Yeah, yeah. Oh,
I know, yes. Which and he is... actually has his moments still, but given this show that I'm going to be posting, he basically recounts his experience using nonviolent communication. So he has evolved similarly to us, realizing that this is really not helpful. And I knew from the outset, you know, Chaim Ganat said labeling is disabling. Mm-hmm. It's very true. Because it pigeonholes people, it categorizes, and it, you know, the overgeneralization aspect.
And what does it do for you as the labeler, right? It's not producing warm and fuzziness in your head either when you're doing it.
No, you can vent, you can rant. Those are some of the quasi positives, but ultimately they're not so positive because you're not really getting your needs met. You're not really able to affect any sort of change in your environment that you're labeling as a certain way. Yeah.
I've tried to temper it better on the show, too. And the show is entertaining, and people expect, I think, a certain acerbic quality now and then. But I did realize that talking that it's that language, you know, those words do become thoughts. Right. And those thoughts can be pretty powerful and pretty persistent. And the only place where those thoughts exist, you know, I can't like do my hands like a wizard and send those negative thoughts to all these people I'm having them about. That stuff only goes on in my head. Right.
Yeah.
Now I'm picturing the Emperor from Star Wars. Oh, you're right. My right brain is very active tonight with the
really is
the electricity. These are my thoughts about you. Right.
This is your brain on School Sucks podcast. And those people aren't going to work diligently to get out of the straitjacket of the label that you put on them. Right. And achieve something that you actually like and want, because the labeling again is going to be disabling for you and for them in this process of change.
Yeah. You know, a resentment towards somebody else really only affects the person who has the resentment. So, yeah, labeling and mislabeling.
Yeah, and of course, we've been talking about how it's directed outward, but this is also in a therapeutic way directed, or non-therapeutic way. I'm just talking therapeutic context. This is, you know, Burns wanted to help people with their self-labeling process that's very destructive and very, debilitating for people. And, to step outside of that and to see more possibilities and to actually get more specific about things you don't like or like, and, you know, look at behavior patterns rather than this generalized way of describing something, just something to something that you don't really appreciate or that you think is significant. Yeah, the terms absolute and unalterable are kind of... key for understanding the pitfall of labeling, huh? Because it really locks people into a status quo situation, doesn't it?
Sure. And it self-labeling, just applying labels to yourself or to your behaviors is one thing, but applying those negative labels to something else, I think this relates to what I was saying before, can also affect a person's attitude. And really, this has been a theme on my show recently, ascribing an urgency to a situation where that urgency might not exist. So one of the cognitive restructuring tips would be trying to exchange or replace some common vocabulary with things that all the way back to the black and white thinking are less absolute. Right? Must becomes prefer, should becomes choose to, have to becomes want.
Yes.
So that can change a whole person's frame of mind in a positive way.
Are you
way.
Referring to the clear communication?
Not. Link? No. Is that something I have in front of me?
Yeah, I'll give you that link too, because it was part of this Camp Augusta, this guy that I sat next to on the plane that asked me, hey, have you heard of School Sucks podcast? And that was pretty interesting. The world got a lot smaller, but he'd been working at this Camp Augusta for kids summer camp up in Northern California. And the guy that created this camp actually incorporates a lot of nonviolent communication and another methodology called clear communication. I can give you the link to that. But there is that sort of restructuring of the shoulds into more of a choice-based, open possibility type process.
Mm. Yeah. Yes, I do remember you telling me that. So hi to that guy, if he still listens.
Yeah.
Thank you for William. Spreading the message all the way to, where did that occur? In a plane over the South Pacific somewhere?
Yeah, we were flying to Fiji, and then he was going off to New Zealand for a few months just to take in all the epic scenery there. So
cool.
Our paths will probably cross again at some point. He just said he was interested in the whole liberty activism stuff, so I directed Excellent. Him to freestateproject.com.
Yes, so hopefully your paths will cross again.
Yeah.
The last one on the list, personalization. Attribution of personal responsibility for events over which a person has no control. It says, or causal mm-hmm. role, or blame for events over which a person has no control. Gosh, poor Barack Obama. Probably the biggest victim of this in the country right now, I would say. Even though in many ways he might have asked for it. Man, he is like a guy trying to ride a bull on steroids and crack, you know? And
yes.
It's true with anybody in that position at any time. And I think there might be a certain psychology that often leads people into that quest or that desire for those kinds of positions of power. And I would have to think once they get there, they realize that they're pretty impotent in many ways, and everything is kind of has a momentum that they really can't redirect. But this is certainly also applies elsewhere besides mm-hmm. our nation's highest office.
Yeah, the other page on Psych Central has this description. It's a distortion where a person believes that everything others do or say is some kind of direct personal reaction to the person. We also compare ourselves to others, trying to determine who is smarter, better looking, etc.
Oh,
a person
yeah.
engaged in personalization may also see themselves as the cause of some unhealthy external event that they were not responsible for. So they blame themselves, yeah. For example, we were late to the dinner party and caused the hostess to overcook the meal. If I had only pushed my husband to leave on time, this wouldn't have happened.
Mm.
So this gets into the self-defeating thinking that happens with people expressing their depression and their down moods about things. They're putting themselves down that they should have done differently, right? But they didn't. If only I'd done this.
Yeah, and that rage can go in and become depression, or that can go out and become aggression, because I think it would be just as common, it would seem, that somebody else would assign personal responsibility to a spouse or a child. You did this, this was your fault, when there were many factors to an event taking place. But because there might already be a certain level of anger or resentment, this one unfortunate situation can allow for personalization to take place, where all of that resentment or anger that hasn't been dealt with is directed towards that person in one event.
Yes, yes.
Maybe one of kids, these. Yeah, kids could even do it to their parents when they say, "You ruined my life," says the 16-year-old.
Exactly, exactly. Ruined my life. Well, basically expressing the fact that her needs didn't get met. She wanted to do something that was thwarted by the parents. But what would be a more realistic way to look at it, right? That's, what we really want to do with these fallacies, these biases, these distortions, is look at things through a clearer lens about reality and about our own capabilities. so that we don't get mired in this sort of thinking. One of the fallacies or the distortions on this page that's closely related to personalization is control fallacies. If we feel externally controlled, we see ourselves as helpless, as a helpless victim of fate. For example, I can't help it if the quality of the work is poor. My boss demanded I work overtime on it. The fallacy of internal control has us assuming responsibility for the pain and happiness of everyone around us. For example, why aren't you happy? Is it because of something I did? You know? And this speaks to nonviolent communication, talking about the different pseudo feelings, you know, that are combined with the evaluations that are not really helpful for getting a clear understanding of what a person is really feeling and what we can do about it in terms of fulfilling their request. So yeah, the locus of control, that's pretty interesting. There's that matrix that I've seen before about how people attribute things, you know, when they downplay their own ability to do something and they magnify other people's ability to do something. They mentioned that in the previous distortion, right? About people that are when they're depressed, they tend to see other people as doing all the right things and making all the right choices, right? But they're the only one that doesn't do that.
Yeah.
That's kind of a common one as well. So yeah, where do people get these ideas? Why is the human mind engaging in all this stuff? I think a lot of it relates to their own upbringing and the domination culture that they live in and the rewards punishments model that you've talked about before in the show.
Sure.
The carrots and stick. The way that people, adults, interact with children is not always self-esteeming. It's not always honoring their own capacity to make their own choices in an efficacious way. You know, there's a lot of mistrust in kids and a lot of downplaying their own potentials, because they got to fit into a mold or fit into the system or go to school and obey all these demands.
Yeah, that domination system brings personalization right back up, because I think a factor in how a person might place blame on themselves is how, you know, how large somebody else is looming in their life or in his or her life. Like, for example, if a boss is pissed at work, you know, employee might say, what am I doing wrong? If significant other is, you know, in a period of emotional distress, boyfriend or girlfriend might say, what did I do to make this happen? But most importantly, when a parent is miserable or a marriage doesn't work, the child might apply that same blame to themselves, even if they don't consciously realize it. So I think the presence that an authority figure or a significant other might have, the importance that they might have in the life of a person, and obviously the most significant example of that is parent-child, then personalization, because mainly because of the domination culture, could be really destructive.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's something that really needs to be focused on. I appreciate the conversation, because we could go on and on about this stuff. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to think in distorted ways about ourselves, about others. Fortunately, there are mood repair strategies, and there's actually a Wikipedia page called that, and it talks about this process of disputing these negative thoughts, to identify them and dispute them and think of other alternatives that are true and realistic, and replace them with more realistic ideas about self and others. And of course, there's Burns' book, The Feeling Good, and The Feeling Good Guide or Handbook he has too, which I think has a whole bunch of different exercises to work through these processes.
Mm. And the vocabulary exchange has been helpful for me, even though it's created some more challenges with editing my podcast, where I say something one way, you know, which feels natural, or maybe more importantly, feels easy to say it that way. Mm-hmm. The words just come out, and then I stop and say, that's not the best way to characterize that person or that situation, and, you know, say it again using different language. And really, more importantly, being able to do that in my own head is very helpful. And also recognizing the underlying beliefs that are activated by a certain situation, you know, and questioning those beliefs. Are they rational? Are they irrational? Where do they come from? And if they're irrational and they're acted upon, what consequences do they lead to? And what healthier, more constructive beliefs could be put in their place? And it's, you know, gaining that control of the operating system that is the mind is a big part of what cognitive restructuring seems to be about.
Absolutely. Yeah, because this other Wikipedia page for the Feeling Good book, The New Mood Therapy, talks about the idea that negative feelings such as depression and anxiety are triggered by our thoughts or perceptions. And this has a long history dating back to the Greek philosopher Epictetus, I guess that's the pronunciation, who said that people are disturbed not by things, but by the way we think about them. Yeah. So the things that are going on in our head, how we're looking at reality, really has the biggest impact, I think, in terms of giving rise to feelings. And so if you can change the thought patterns, that the process of cognitive behavioral therapy is that you can change what you feel ultimately. Your feelings are automatic, obviously they come out, but this process of restructuring over time will yield different feelings.
Mm. Yeah.
And so that's very empowering, you know?
Yeah, and to not beat oneself up over those feelings because they're going to come, but recognizing them as opportunities. You know,
indeed.
Even if they create a negative interaction or a negative social situation, which occasionally they might, it doesn't mean that the opportunity still doesn't exist to do better. So, and to learn from that. So why don't we call that a show, sir? That we did pretty good. We said 1 hour, and here we are at about an hour and a half. That's
perfect
reasonable.
Perfect timing, as usual. Yeah. Indeed. Yeah, this was a lot of fun. And I look forward to teasing out other parts of this in the future if we need to.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you just give your sites and anything that people should know before you go?
Sure. My main website is cognitive therapy. No, it's actually completeliberty.com. But I also have a site related to therapy and counseling called happinesscounseling.com. So I'm doing groups and individual sessions there too. So I have a whole list of resources, by the way, on happinesscounseling.com. You just click on resources and there's a whole human software upgrade process there, philosophy and psychology stuff.
Excellent. Thanks again, Wes.
You're welcome. Appreciate it.
We are stars. We are guests. We are caught in the devil's plan. And we like to get ourselves back to the God.
Okay, everybody, here we go with some new subscriber geography trivia. I know I've used this background beatbox loop. I found this on a YouTube video. Somebody sent me this Key and Peele video. Sydney Rock from the Gaming Liberty podcast sent me this video, and at the end of their videos they have like this 10-second beatbox just when they put up like the title, and I was like, that is so addictive. I recorded it and then looped it so it would go on for 10 minutes. I think it's the perfect beat background to start practicing my freestyle rapping, something I've wanted to get into for a long time here. And maybe we could even incorporate it into our after show. People could call, they could rap, we could do a little back and forth, we could do some battles. They don't have to be antagonistic. I don't think rap battles have to be antagonistic. But I also learned from Eminem that it's okay to keep a little notebook of words that rhyme with each other, and when you're doing a freestyle rap battle, you can bring it up on stage with you if you need it. So that's good to know. It doesn't all just have to come out of nowhere. This is a good way to keep those, you know, neural pathways open and maybe even tap into the subconscious a little bit. So I thought about trying to freestyle this whole new subscriber geography trivia, but when you have to incorporate geography facts, yeah, it really breaks up the flow, you know, when you have a list of things that you need to say. And my understanding is that it's supposed to rhyme, so So maybe when a few more people subscribe, and I've had this on my iPod for a couple weeks, and I have some time to practice in my car, then maybe in the future we can actually wrap these things out. But first we have Demetra, and Demetra is in Brookline, Massachusetts. That's an area I'm very familiar with. Brookline is, you know, I guess technically, I don't want to offend Demetra, but it's technically part of Boston, even though Brookline likes to maintain its own identity. We're all familiar with the outcome of the 1873 Great Annexation debate between Brookline and Boston, which did not go in Boston's favor, let me tell you. But Larry Bird and Conan O'Brien, two of the taller, whiter men that you will see out there in the world, both lived in Brookline. John F. Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy were born there. It's a beautiful little city. It's more like a suburb of Boston, I would say. Next, we have Renate, who is in Hamburg, Germany. Now, the history of this place is pretty grim, but I wanted to stay away from that. We, you know, certainly could talk about the RAF bombings during World War II and the firestorms and the Viking invasions and Valdemar II of the Netherlands raiding the city twice in the early Middle Ages, but I thought we would maybe go with something a little more positive. The Beatles launched their career in Hamburg, Germany. John Paul, Luke, Ringo, playing in small music clubs in the early 1960s before they came to the United States, the Beatles. And then we have Greg S., who is in Mesa, Arizona. Mesa is Spanish for table. Now, I wanted to do the story of the Lost Dutchman's Gold Mine, which is in the Superstition Mountains outside of Mesa. By the way, Dutchman actually means a German. I didn't know that. It's an American slang because of Deutsch. Back in the 19th century, when this gentleman, Waltz, was around and supposedly found this mine and kept it a secret, they called Deutsch Dutch, and Germans were Dutchmen. How about that? But then, as I was doing a Google search on Mesa, I found the story of a man named Bernardo Lapallo, who is the world's oldest blogger living in Mesa, who in August turned 111 years old. Here's the story.
Good living, baby. Just taking care of my body.
Bernardo walks a mile every morning, and when he invited us into his home several years ago, he shared with me he sticks to his father's advice of only eating a strict diet.
I live on green vegetables, fruit.
And the one thing he says he can't live without, olive oil.
I bathe my feet every night and massage them in olive oil. Never had a corn. I guarantee anybody that you've got, I'll take off my shoes right now and my feet are as soft as their face.
Bernardo's life lesson.
Everything in moderation, whatever it might be.
Including life.
I make plans to live because I know I'm going to die, but I'm making plans to live.
Another thing. If you subscribed in the last few months and you never heard one of these for you, please let me know. Definitely put one together. You send me the name of the place you live. I actually got an email from a listener named Christoph, who I met at the last Pork Fest. And I knew he lived in Pennsylvania, but he said he never heard one for his location. And I said, I don't know. I don't remember, because he lived in a common place. I think we have a lot of people in Pennsylvania, too. Let me tell you about the gift that he gave me. He said, if you do it, I want my location to be Antarctica. And I said, ooh, I don't know that much about Antarctica. And boy, what a fun research project. I learned quite a bit. Now, first of all, there is no really firm record or evidence that any person, any human being, even saw the continent of Antarctica prior to the year 1820. It was the Russians sighted it first. Antarctica, technically, is a desert, because there are only 8 inches of precipitation there each year on average. And 70% of the world's freshwater is stored in the ice in Antarctica. So thanks. You know, if you want to, here's an idea too. If you want to make up your own location, that could be a good way for me to learn about different places. You know, so if there's a place that you think I should learn about, just say you live there. You have to let me know. Now, I love astronomy, so think about saying that maybe you live on a different planet. And then I could learn a little bit more about those planets.